Let's go now to the chapter dealing with the endomembrane system and peroxisomes. And the reason the title is like that is because peroxisomes, even though they're included in this chapter, are not a member, officially, of the endomembrane system. The endomembrane system includes things that should be familiar with to you already. It includes the endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi apparatus, or Golgi complex, and endosomes, and various sorts of vesicles, and finally, lysosomes. Now, all of these things that I just mentioned are singly membrane-bounded organelles, right? They just have one layer of membrane. I mean, that one layer is a phospholipid bilayer, but it's not two layers like the nuclear envelope is. There are other singly membrane-bounded organelles in the cell, including peroxisomes, but they're not members of this endomembrane system, because what makes the whole thing an endomembrane system is that membrane gets passed around continuously from member to member of the endomembrane system. And the plasma membrane is involved as well, but the plasma membrane, most people don't consider that part of the endomembrane system, because endomembrane means within the cell, right? And the plasma membrane is not. But membrane gets shared between all of these members of the endomembrane system and the plasma membrane. And although there are many different compartments, because all of these vesicles going in various directions are members of the endomembrane system, and also there are several different subcompartments within the two major organelles, endoplasmic reticulum and Golgi apparatus, but all of those spaces combined make up basically an endomembrane system's interior, which is separate from the cytosol, right? Even though it's separate little compartments, they're all separate from the cytosol. Remember when we talked originally about the endoplasmic reticulum, at least I think I mentioned the fact that the membrane that makes up the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, which you can see right here. So, saying that these things are officially the members of the endomembrane system is really just an artificial way for us to group things together. Because who's to say, at what molecule does the membrane stop being part of the nuclear envelope and start being a member of the endomembrane system? Well, it's kind of foolish to even ask that question. Anyway, though, those are the official members. And what is it that makes the difference between rough and smooth ER? The appearance of ribosomes, which are associated with the rough endoplasmic reticulum's membrane only temporarily. At any given moment, it seems like there are many there. I mean, there are many there, but they're not going to be there later. A whole new population of ribosomes will be there later, because the ribosomes are only on that surface while they are doing their job, which in general is what for a ribosome? Translation, right. Translation is the job of any ribosome, whether it's a free ribosome out in the cytosol or one that is bound to the endoplasmic reticular membrane. But the reason they are bound to the endoplasmic reticular membrane, these ribosomes, some of the ribosomes, is that the polypeptide that they are translating, or the messenger RNA that they are translating into a polypeptide, is one of these polypeptides that is going to be modified by the endomembrane system. And so, if you think of translation as occurring as it happens by single addition of an amino acid to a growing chain of amino acids that we call the growing polypeptide. That growing polypeptide ends up getting threaded into the interior of the endoplasmic reticulum. And in that endoplasmic reticulum's lumen, some sort of modification is going to take place, which can be many different things. I mean, it might be some of the amino acids get removed. It might be other things get added to the protein. For instance, glycosylation, which means addition of a sugar to the protein to make a glycoprotein. All kinds of modifications occur, not only in the endoplasmic reticulum's lumen, but modification can continue to occur after that protein gets sent to the Golgi complex. And so this is in keeping with the fact that it's all one endomembrane system doing different things in different compartments at different times, but all these pieces of membrane are moving around. When a vesicle buds off of the endoplasmic reticulum, that vesicle is a member of the endomembrane system, and then when it fuses with the Golgi complex, it's now a member of the Golgi complex, which is a member of the endomembrane system. And next moment, it might be part of the plasma membrane, or it could be a vesicle, a different kind of vesicle. That's why it's all combined. Now, peroxisomes, I'll talk about at the end of the chapter. They are not actually considered part of the endomembrane system, though, even though more and more evidence is accumulating that some of them, at least, get created by pinching off of the endomembrane system. Although the not can happen differently as well. Okay, let's go to two. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum is not involved in protein modification, which is why it doesn't have ribosomes associated with it. It's smooth. Not only you could tell, even if there weren't any ribosomes, you could tell the difference between smooth ER and rough ER just because of the shape. Even though it's all one organelle and it's all continuous membrane, the rough ER is more like flattened discs, whereas the smooth ER is more like tubes. And so even without those ribosomes, you'd be able to tell them apart. What is the major job in most cells of the smooth ER? Lipid synthesis. So cholesterol is made there, but also phospholipids. And so smooth ER, a member itself of the endomembrane system, is really the chief engine of new membrane, because you have to make phospholipids in order to make new membrane, right? That occurs in smooth ER. There are also, in certain cells, specialized functions for it as well. Smooth ER, for instance, is a major place where calcium ions are stored. In skeletal muscle, for instance, this is the major job of the smooth ER. Those calcium ions need to be sequestered from the cytosol, so that they do not interact with proteins that would otherwise allow for the contraction of your muscles. You only want your muscles to contract when your brain is telling your muscles to contract. So in response to that, calcium ions get released from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum into the cytosol, where they allow interactions of proteins that allow for contraction of the muscle. But as soon as your brain is done telling the skeletal muscle to contract, it needs to relax again, which means those ions need to be pumped back into the smooth ER in those cells. Well, in this slide, we're seeing still another use of it. Actually, this is not something, though, that's happening in the lumen of the smooth ER. This is a liver cell, and one of the many functions of the liver is glycogenolysis, which is the breakdown of glycogen into glucose, right? Glycogen was produced by the liver originally as a storage polysaccharide, meaning we're keeping this here as glucose for use as a fuel later, but right now we don't need that glucose. When it comes time to needing it again, glycogenolysis, which is the reverse of glycogenesis, takes place. All right? Now, doing that involves several steps, but the final step is to, after the glucose is freed from the polymer, it's in the form of glucose 6-phosphate, as you see here. Glucose 6-phosphate needs to be dephosphorylated because that phosphate, as I said before, locks it into the cell, which is why a cell taking in glucose for its own immediately phosphorylates it. Well, here you have it phosphorylated at a different position, but it still locks it in the cell. The liver is trying to liberate this glucose into the bloodstream to keep the brain alive. So it needs a dephosphorylation step, and that dephosphorylation step, which is performed by glucose 6-phosphatase, makes sense that it's a phosphatase, right? Because it removes a phosphate, opposite of a kinase. That enzyme, that phosphatase enzyme, is bound to the smooth ER membrane, but it operates on the cytosolic face of it. So it's connected to the smooth ER, but what's happening is that actually happening out in the cytosol of the liver cell. Still, though, without that contribution of the smooth ER, this wouldn't happen, and the glucose wouldn't be able to get out of the liver cell, and the brain would die, and therefore the person would die. Let's take another look in slide 3 at the Golgi complex, because we've mentioned a lot of this before. Remember that the Golgi is a polar organelle. It has different faces to it. So we use the terminology cis and trans to differentiate the two faces, or to distinguish them. The CGN refers to the cis Golgi network, and the TGN, the trans Golgi network. In between those two faces, which are basically the extremes of it, are the medial cisternae. Cisternae is a plural of cisterna. Cisterna is just a Latinized word for cistern, which means tank, basically. So these little flattened discs that make up the stuff of the Golgi are cisternae. And therefore, the Golgi overall really has multiple spaces, has multiple lumens. Because not only are there cisterns, but there are also various vesicles that are almost to or just leaving the Golgi. But we tend to talk about the Golgi lumen as though it's just one space. It's not really just one space. There are a couple major hypotheses about how the Golgi is actually formed. In one hypothesis, the medial cisternae are kept in place, and things get sent to them from the cis face, and then vesicles will bud from one cisterna, go to the next one, and so on. But the cisternae stay in place, and then eventually the trans face receives vesicles from that last medial cisterna. Evidence is getting more and more convincing, though, that that's probably not what is occurring. Instead, it's the competing hypothesis says that there is a maturation of these cisternae, meaning that the cisternae themselves are moving from cis to trans and getting mature as they do, and therefore different things are happening in them along the way. And the trans Golgi network actually will be made up of that oldest medial cisterna once it finally gets to that side. So things are just moving continuously from cis to trans face. And the biggest piece of compelling evidence about this is that we find things that are way too big to be put into vesicles that leave, you would have to do that in order for them to leave one cisterna. But we find them in each one. So really the only way to explain that happening is that they never really leave the cisterna. They're always locked in there, but the cisterna itself is moving. So that is probably more of what's happening. Anyway, there's the jury is a little bit still out on that. Well, the cis Golgi network is the incoming part of the organelle, and that's the part that is in close association with the rough endoplasmic reticulum, or I should just say the ER in general, both rough and smooth. So there is a, usually there is a, I mean, it, more often than not, there is a flow of materials from endoplasmic reticulum to Golgi complex, but there can be a flow in the reverse direction as well. Okay? It's just that most things go from ER to Golgi. The trans-Golgi network, on the other hand, is closer to the plasma membrane. Well, in slide 4, we can see kind of what I was talking about in terms of reversal of movement. In the blue circles, we have what's called anterograde transport, meaning in the forward direction. And that's what most movement is. You have polypeptides being built and strung into the lumen of the rough ER originally. They get modified, like I said, within that lumen and then packaged into vesicles, these transition vesicles by the number 2 here, which then fuse with the cis face of the Golgi. That's a forward direction. Then several more vesicles can be formed during the trip through the Golgi, until finally, if it's a protein that's going to be secreted, meaning removed from the cell, it will be packaged in secretory vesicles, which then fuse with the plasma membrane for the purpose of exocytosis. And that's the normal situation. Of course, you also have things coming into the cell via endocytosis, and whatever gets endocytosed ends up being packaged first in a vesicle. They coalesce into endosomes and eventually mature into lysosomes. Well, this is moving in the opposite direction. The lysosomes can produce vesicles themselves with little packages from the processing of the whatever was brought in by endocytosis, and those can be delivered to either of the two major organelles. This is all making up retrograde transport, in other words, backward movement. But it's all vesicular trafficking, and so it's involving not just these members of the endomembrane system, but importantly, things that are not shown here, an extensive cytoskeletal network, because these vesicles are not just floating through liquid randomly getting to their destination. They're being taken to a specific destination along cytoskeletal elements. Yeah. Yes, but that's why I was saying after processing of the contents, some of the things that get that are products of that hydrolysis can then be taken somewhere else via this retrograde movement. Okay, now to 5, let's talk about this is exocytosis being shown here, and exocytosis is vesicular transport. That's the most general of the terms. That just means transport into or out of a cell via a vesicle. There's two major types of vesicular transport, right? Exocytosis and endocytosis. We're looking at exocytosis here, which is outward movement via a vesicle. Outward vesicular transport, in other words. And for this to happen, the cell has to already have a vesicle produced inside the cell that packages whatever the secretory product is that needs to be released from the cell. and that secretory vesicle docks with the interior of the plasma membrane, and then it gets opened up. When that happens, the membrane that was the vesicle is now just part of the plasma membrane. And as it opens up, the secretory product gets expelled into the exterior. So notice, just like all vesicular transport, whatever's being transported really never crosses a membrane. But exocytosis can work either to fully secrete a product onto its own outside of the cell. That would be something that is contained within the vesicle originally. Or it can also put proteins into the plasma membrane. That would be proteins that are membrane bound on the vesicle. Not fully inside the vesicle, but in the membrane of the vesicle. Okay? Well, if a protein is embedded in the membrane of a vesicle, and that vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane and becomes part of the plasma membrane, now that protein is in the plasma membrane. And, I'll talk more about that in a minute. So, I mean, don't think of exocytosis as only being to fully export things out of the cell. It's also the major way in which you put new proteins into the plasma membrane, because the plasma membrane, sometimes you want proteins there, sometimes you don't. For instance, receptors, right? This is how upregulation or downregulation can occur. You either add more receptors or reduce the amount of receptors. Well, you would reduce them by the reverse process, which would be endocytosis. And speaking of which, that's shown in slide 6. This is the reverse of exocytosis, really, which is endocytosis, another general word that just refers to any inward vesicular movement or vesicular transport, into the cell. Now, we can subdivide endocytosis into two major types as well. Strictly speaking, three types. What am I talking about? What are the subtypes? What kinds of endocytosis are there specifically? Phagocytosis is one, right? Pinocytosis. Those mean cell eating and cell drinking, respectively. In phagocytosis, there is some fairly large chunk, solid chunk outside the cell that gets endocytosed. That makes it phagocytosis. In pinocytosis, it's really just continuous vesicles being formed of whatever happens to be in that liquid. So it's not a big solid chunk, it's just taking little sips of the extracellular fluid continuously. And the third would be receptor-mediated endocytosis, which is the usual kind of endocytosis, really. But we'll look at a slide of that in a minute. In any case, what happens here is really just the reverse. The plasma membrane invaginates. It's still one plasma membrane there. It just has an invagination or an infolding in it. When the infolding gets severe enough, then it pinches off, and now you have a vesicle containing something inside, and that stuff that's now in the cell never crossed a membrane. It just got wrapped around by a membrane. Well, in 7, we can see phagocytosis. This is phagocytosis of a bacterium. And the reason this is happening, as you see, is because there are receptors for that, for molecules that are on the surface of that bacterium. In other words, this cell isn't going to produce these pseudopods to surround something that's not there. It's not just taking little sips automatically like it does in pinocytosis. This is receptor-mediated, which means receptor proteins are acting as a mediator, or they're necessary for the process to occur. A receptor, of course, is something that's not going to do anything unless the thing it's a specific thing that it's a receptor for is present. Well, in this case, it's that bacterium that's causing the phagocytosis to happen. Eight. Most vesicles are examples of what we call coated vesicles, because they're not just phospholipid bilayers. They're little pieces of full membrane, and they're called coated because on the surface of the membrane making up a vesicle are many different kinds, many copies of proteins of some sort. And there are a few major categories of coding proteins, some of which are just called coding protein 1, coding protein 2, but also the one shown here, clathrin. And so, if in the cases in which clathrin is the coding protein, we call these things clathrin-coated vesicles. This is really what's behind receptor-mediated endocytosis. Okay, so the clathrin, which is on the cytosolic face of the plasma membrane, accumulates as proteins. The more that get there, the more that it starts forming an invagination because of the interaction between the clathrins. So that's actually what causes this plasma membrane to bulge inward. Or not bulge inward, to cave inward. But notice that associated with the extracellular surface are receptor proteins, specific for something. In this case, it happens to be the hexagonal ligands that we see in cartoon form. Well, when the ligand binds to the receptor, which is a signal that it's actually there to the cell, that actually brings on the ability for clathrin on the other side, the cytosolic side, to gather there. And so these clathrin-coated pits don't form unless there is the appropriate stuff there that you want to endocytose. Because they've bound to the receptors, that causes changes that allows the coated pits to form. And at the formation of the coated pits, the accumulation of the clathrin is what causes it to invaginate originally. So that gets the ball rolling. Dynamin is a different protein that is necessary to finish it, basically, to snip it off from the plasma membrane when the two sides come together. And so it officially forms the vesicle. It's now separate from the plasma membrane. After you have the coated vesicle formed inside the cell, then it undergoes uncoating. All right, stuff happens to whatever the contents are, which is typically to digest it. If what's coming in is something that it needs to be degraded, that vesicle will fuse with other vesicles called early endosomes to form bigger and more mature endosomes that contain not only what has been brought in by phagocytosis or endocytosis in general, but also by fusing them with other endosomes that have been budding off of the endomembrane system, those other endosomes will contain various enzymes to deal with the stuff that's being brought in by endocytosis. And so when they fuse together to form these more mature endosomes, eventually what you have is called no longer an endosome, but a lysosome. Because the lysosome contains the enzymes necessary for hydrolysis, which is why it's called lysosome, along with the stuff that's going to be hydrolyzed, which is the stuff that came in via endocytosis. And so that hydrolysis takes place inside the lysosome. Now, this makes sense, and I'm sure we talked about this at least a little bit before. makes sense that this occurs in a lysosome rather than the cytoplasm, right? Because those hydrolytic enzymes, which break things apart, are dangerous things to have around the various components of the cell that you don't want to digest. So it's that hydrolysis process is sequestered to the interior of lysosomes. Well, that forms various breakdown products, which can be sent basically anywhere in the cell, but some of it might be sent back out of the cell. And that's what this transcytosis at 7C is forming. Transcytosis refers to moving all the way through the cell. So you have endocytosis at one side of the cell, you deal with it somehow, changing it, and then you exocytose it at the other edge of the cell. So the whole process would be transcytosis. After products are removed from the lysosome, you have a little vesicle that still contains these receptors originally, and those are still valuable as receptors. They can't do any job of being receptors inside the cell, though, so you need to move that thing back to the plasma membrane to fuse with it so it becomes part of the plasma membrane again, and that will send those receptors outward again. Now, it's importantly notice that there is always directionality to any membrane, whether it's a vesicle or part of the Golgi or part of the endoplasmic reticulum or part of the plasma membrane, meaning that there's a cytosolic side and a non-cytosolic side. For all of the members of the endomembrane system, the non-cytosolic side would be the luminal side, right? The side facing away from the cytosol would be facing the lumen. For the plasma membrane, the non-cytosolic side would be the extracellular side. The point here is that when a protein first gets bound to a membrane, if it's one of the proteins that doesn't go all the way into the lumen of the ER, but gets stuck in the membrane of the ER, either by covalent binding to one of the phospholipids or just by the fact that it has hydrophilic and hydrophobic parts that keep it in the membrane, in any case, it's going to be associated, in most cases, with one of the monolayers of the bilayer. So it's going to be associated with one face of the overall membrane, either cytosolic or non-cytosolic. Well, let's say that it's associated with the non-cytosolic face of the endoplasmic reticulum originally. When that gets packaged into a vesicle, it's now part of the membrane of the vesicle itself. It's no longer part of the ER, right? But by budding off of the ER, it still has the same spatial arrangement. It's still going to be, now it's going to be associated with the vesicle, but it's still going to be associated with the non-cytosolic part of it, right? It's going to be facing the interior of the vesicle. When that vesicle, even if it goes, becomes part of the Golgi, it's not going to change. And if now it's in a brand new vesicle. No matter how many vesicles later, it still will be associated with the non-cytosolic face. Now, if that merges with the plasma membrane and folds outward, that protein that's now part of the plasma membrane will still be non-cytosolic, which means it's going to be facing outward. Okay? Which is the extracellular face. By the way, if a cell needs to change that situation, needs to change it from one monolayer to the other, it has to use specific enzymes called flipases that will force it to go onto the other monolayer. It doesn't just happen very often on its own, for reasons I discussed when we were talking about membrane in general. What I wanted to talk about on 9, because a lot of this is kind of repetitive with respect to 8, is that it's not just things that get taken into the cell that get digested in lysosomes. Often, the things that get digested in lysosomes are actually old parts of the cell. Just organelles that have seen better days. They're just worn out. So the cell is always breaking down older things and then making new replacements. The breaking down of cellular components, because they're old and worn out, is called autophagy, which literally means self-eating, right? So it's you don't just, you know, if it's an old mitochondrion no longer functioning well, it can be undergo autophagy. You don't just spit it out, because it's made of a bunch of valuable materials that are just not working together as a functional unit anymore. But it's all organic molecules it's made out of, so you break them down into their subunits, which then can be used as subunits to reassemble into something that works. That happens in lysosomes via autophagy. And I guess I have to quit there.